From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we continue our series of conversations with state leaders after the recent passage of the New York State budget. It's a chance to sit down with those who voted either for or against the budget to talk about what's in it, what's not, what their biggest disappointments are, everything in between, what the biggest wins are, perhaps. We'll be talking about housing, of course, public safety. We'll talk about everything from labor bills to worker safety, an anti-bullying effort. We'll talk about everything that's in sort of these recent housing bills to help you understand what is there and what is not. We'll talk about support for migrants. New York State spending $2.4 billion to help New York City address its migrant crisis. And we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about, listeners, if you want to call the program or if you want to email. The number to call is 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994, and you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Assemblymember Harry Bronson from District Number 138 is our guest in studio. Assemblymember, welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
Evan, thank you so much for having me on again.
We always start with, you know, what disappointed you most? No budget is perfect, at least in the eyes of most lawmakers. So when you look at this budget, you say, boy, I'm really disappointed about what?
So I think in this particular budget, I'm disappointed that we didn't get the temporary disability wage replacement in the budget, nor did we get it done at the end of session. I'm also disappointed we didn't do more in the area of climate. We have very ambitious climate goals, and there were some measures that I was hoping we would be able to get in the budget or get passed by the end of session, and those things didn't happen. Indeed, the Assembly, the only climate thing we did, which I am a co-sponsor of and support wholeheartedly, is the Climate Superfund, which would require those with the fossil fuels and to pay into a fund that then we would use to invest in sustainable and renewable energies and help make that transition in an equitable and just way. So that's the one we got done, but we didn't get the New York Heat Act done and other measures that I wish we had done.
What would the New York Heat Act do?
So the New York Heat Act would have helped to make the transition to renewables. So it would reduce reliance on gas lines and things of that nature. We have a lot of incentives in our current law to incentivize utility companies to continue to build that infrastructure. In essence, the New York Heat Act would pull those back and instead incentivize the infrastructure of renewable and sustainable energies.
One of your colleagues on the Republican side, Stephen Hawley, was on this program yesterday. And he told listeners that the state has now mandated any new builds of any kind to be fully electric and that it's overly regulatory and that doesn't allow for freedom of builders to decide how they want to build. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that it's important that we recognize what's happening with climate change, and we have to, as a state, respond to that. And so sometimes that response is to incentivize a change in the way we're doing things. Other times it's mandating it. And indeed, there are mandates with new builds. We're not, unlike what a lot of people say, we're not going to require you to pull out your gas stove out of your current house. We're not going to require you to convert your current house from fossil fuels to renewable, sustainable energy, electricity in particular. That's not what the mandate is. But it is saying that if it's a new build, then we need to encourage electric houses. And I might point out, I live in an all-electric house, so a very old farmhouse, but we use geothermal to heat and cool the farmhouse and a heat exchange for the smaller unit.
When did you make that changeover?
I didn't. I married into it.
when did the changeover happen?
My father-in-law made that change, oh my gosh, almost 20 years ago.
Oh, wow, about 20 years
ago. And has updated it, so he was right on the forefront of doing that.
And it's worked out well?
It's worked very well.
Okay. So I want to ask you about something that may seem a little wonky or esoteric or even off the radar for a lot of listeners up here, but Karen DeWitt, a longtime Capital Bureau correspondent who is retiring a week from tomorrow, was on this program doing a kind of the This Is Your Life Karen DeWitt episode earlier this week. And she told us that toward the end of session, She said it wasn't a scandal, but it did lead to a controversy with the governor regarding congestion pricing, that seemed to delay any momentum of getting other bills done. And, you know, up here, I don't know that people are paying attention, but the point that Karen was making was it does seem to have affected what did get done at the end of session outside of that issue. How would you describe it?
Well, first of all, we're going to miss Karen, and I thank her for her service. I mean, she really did a very good job of reporting on what was happening in Albany for many, many years. But indeed, congestion pricing, which is a New York City issue related to charging people traveling into Manhattan, the governor pulled the plug and indefinitely, using her words, indefinitely is delaying the institution of congestion pricing. That created a lot of controversy. There were, you know, it's a very divisive issue for New York City representatives. Some support, some don't. It depends in large part on what area you represent and who's going to be impacted. But the governor pulled it back because of the issue of affordability in New York State. And affordability is not only a New York City issue, it's an issue across the entire state. So she pulled that back because it would put additional burden of expenses on those individuals traveling into Manhattan for work. And so I understand why she pulled it back, but indeed it just pulled the air out of what we were doing for, you know, pretty much a day and a half. And a day and a half at the end of session is very important. We spent a lot of time in conference discussing various approaches on how to fund the MTA in New York City and the surrounding suburbs. And, you know, unfortunately, that meant we didn't have that time to discuss some of the climate bills that we wanted to get through. Some of us wanted to get through the assembly, and we weren't able to, whether it's the bigger, better bottle bill that would increase the deposit, increase what bottles would be covered and would have to be returned for the deposit. The plastic packaging bill didn't get done because we just didn't have the time to continue to work through some of the areas that needed compromise on those bills.
What about New York Heat? Would that have been done, you think?
It might have been, yeah. I think actually New York Heat may have had a better chance of than some of those other two that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And we had on New York Heat, for instance, you know, I'm chair of the Labor Committee, so we had worked out a lot of the labor issues and things of that nature that we needed in that bill. But again, those are three pretty large bills that didn't get done at the end of session.
How is the relationship of Assembly Democrats with this Democratic governor? I mean, there's always going to be some opposition during budget time, but is there a lot of animosity now?
As one of my colleagues said, it doesn't matter who the governor is. We're always going to disagree with them. You know, look, I work very well with Governor Hochul and generally support the things that she's working on. However, there are times when she might not go as far as I would like to. There's times where she may focus in a different area. But certainly, I'm supportive of much of what she's done in the public safety arena. And we know that has seen results. We have a reduction in gun-related crimes across the state. It's pretty phenomenal over the last 2 years. The changes we've had. We have the GIVE program, which is a program to remove guns off from our streets. Here in Rochester, we're doing better than most. I think we've removed 760 or 720 guns, plus an additional 76 ghost guns. That's all or in large part because of the GIVE program. We increased the funding for the GIVE program in the budget this year from $3.12 million to $4.2 million for Rochester specifically. And we've seen the results. Our assaults and gun homicides have gone dramatically over the last couple of years.
Talking to Assemblymember Harry Bronson, I want to touch on an issue that has been politically divisive, I would say, but now there appears, at least to my read of it, a little bit of a disagreement among Democrats. Let me kind of lay the groundwork. I want to talk about support $2.4 billion for migrants in this state. So New York State has authorized in the budget this year, my understanding is $2.4 billion. And listeners, it's nothing new. This has been well reported for the last year. Migrants who are crossing the southern border, you know, without documentation, are ending up in different places. And one of those places is New York City. And New York City's mayor has said that, you know, they are overwhelmed and are struggling with their own services. And so some of those migrants end up in other counties, Monroe County being one of them. As of a couple of months ago, we were told by Ibero that, you know, it was around 200 people and 60 families since last July alone. And that was a couple months ago. I'm sure that number is higher. When I've spoken to your colleagues in the New York State Assembly, they have told me, the Democrats have told me, it would be incorrect to categorize the people who are here as illegal because they are claiming asylum. And that is a legal process. They're going through that process. And they're in desperate times. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was on this program last week, and the senator told us, I'm reading her quote now, she has heard estimates that in New York, of the 150,000 migrants that have come to New York State, two-thirds would not qualify for asylum. And so, in other words, it would be fair to say that, I don't know if abuse is the right word of the asylum system of process, but many of the people who say, well, I'm here claiming asylum, would not be eligible. So I don't know where you stand on that. Why don't you take me through what you think about $2.4 billion for migrants and how you view the asylum process?
So $2.4 billion is a lot of money. In the context of the ultimately enacted budget of $237 billion. So it's a lot of money, but as you compare it to the whole budget, it's not as great as one would think. That being said, we have a real crisis. The reality is we have migrants who are here. We have individuals who indeed have legally come to this country because they are seeking asylum. That's a legal fact. Those who want to continue to name them as illegal aliens or whatever phrase they're using to suggest somehow that they're bad because they're illegal is just fear-mongering. The reality is we have a lot of people who have come to the United States seeking asylum. I don't know of, you know, what you just quoted on how many of them will be successful in their application or not successful. But I know they have a right to, under our current law, to use that approach. And I also think that, you know, I think we should see their humanity. I think we should see who they are and realize, certainly the ones I have spoken with, they are afraid. They have come here for safety. They have come here knowing that they will want, they and wanting to fully participate in our communities, fully participate in our economy, to contribute to our economy, to contribute to our tax base. I mean, they want to do all those things. What we have to do, though, I think as a state and as a country, but certainly our responsibility at the state level, is we have to provide the programs and the services necessary for them to get integrated into our communities while they're seeking asylum and going through that process, and then thereafter if they're successful.
All right, so it sounds to me like you're saying that, yes, some percentage may not win their asylum claims. Some or many will. And that process exists for a reason. But to call this a situation of illegal immigrants is just categorically incorrect.
There's a movement in this country that is using others, being those who are different than us, and using that from a perspective of fear and to discriminate against them. And if they're different than us, they're an other. And if they're an other, they're a threat. And somehow we shouldn't support them and see them as human beings. And I fully disagree with that. And I think When you use the word illegal, that is trying to, you know, plant in the minds of people that somehow they're bad.
All right, one other point on this. I thought there was a moment of dissonance yesterday when your Republican colleague, Assemblymember Hawley, was on the program. I asked him if he had met any of the families who've come here. And he said, no, because when you're, you know, an illegal immigrant, you don't typically announce yourself to the public, which I think is a misread of this. They're literally coming in on buses from New York City and getting services from Ibero and other agencies. And they are well known. They are seeking to work. They are seeking faster work permits than they can often get in 6 to 7 months. And that's an ongoing debate, especially at the federal level. But I asked him if he thought it was inappropriate to even show up across a border and apply for asylum at all. Here's some of what he said.
We want to welcome folks who want a better life for themselves and their children and grandchildren from other areas of the world to come to the United States and do it the right way.
The right way being legal immigration. So,
which they're doing. It's legal immigration. They're doing that. They're coming to our country and they're seeking asylum. There is no distinction in the law whether or not they pass a particular border point or they pass in a non-border point. That isn't the distinction on whether or not they're here legally seeking asylum.
Okay. Assemblymember Brunson joining us. Let's go through some of the things that you're working on most immediately. And that starts with some labor bills. You want to talk about those?
Sure. One bill that passed both houses, I'm very pleased, is the Warehouse Injury Reduction Act. This would cover large warehouse employers. We have an interesting happening with e-commerce. Our warehouses are popping up all over, employing a lot of workers. However, one in every 11 warehouse worker in New York State is injured every year, much higher percentage than other industries. And so what the Warehouse Worker Injury Reduction Act would do is require large employers to put a warehouse reduction plan in place, would require them to do a study on how injuries are happening, and then to come up with ways to reduce those number of injuries, require if they already have medical office on site, it doesn't require one, but if they have one, it would require certain professionals to be staffed in those medical offices. So we're hoping that the governor passes, will sign this into law, and then hopefully we're going to reduce the number of injuries for warehouse workers.
Is there support for this among your colleagues?
There's a lot of support for it. A lot of these folks aren't even represented by unions, but the unions support this. There is a movement. There are some who are organized by the Teamsters. They support it. A lot of co-signers on the bill, and I don't remember the vote count, but it was very large and bipartisan.
Tell me about the Upstate Parity and Minimum Wage Protection Act.
Yeah, so that, you know, that I introduced that because we took a great step forward with minimum wage going up so that it will be at $15 an hour in upstate New York. Something I worked on when I was on staff for the assembly, a counsel to the Labor Committee. Asking for the minimum wage to be indexed, so every time the consumer cost of living would go up, the minimum wage would automatically go up by that percentage. Ultimately, last year, a year ago, that indexing was put into law. Wonderful first step, and credit to Governor Hochul for really pushing that right out of the block. So that was good. But we also put an off-ramp. So if inflation is at a certain level or unemployment insurance is at a certain level, then that automatic increase to inflation would not go in effect. I don't think we should have done that. So this bill would eliminate that. The other thing it would eliminate is we have geographical minimum wage. So upstate's at one level, New York City's at another level, and the suburbs outside of New York City are at a third level. I don't think we should do that. Minimum wage is the baseline. It is the floor. So we should treat it as such, and it should be the floor across the state, and then let the market dictate how much above minimum wage employers would pay based on, you know, the demands of the market. So this bill would create a minimum wage across the board. It would increase it up to $21 an hour over a series of increases over years, continue the indexing, get rid of the off-ramp, but make it a floor across the state.
$20 an hour goes a lot further here than in New York City, though, doesn't it? I mean, if you have a 1,000-square-foot apartment in Rochester and a 1,000-square-foot apartment in Manhattan, they're going to cost very, very different prices to rent or buy, right?
No doubt.
So why should the minimum wage be the same?
Because the minimum wage is a floor. It's the baseline. It isn't the livable wage. It isn't, you know, this is what the state is saying, that you should not go below that because of the impact that it is going to have on the state finances. So if you go below that, then you're going to have people who are getting subsidies and support and things of that nature. So the minimum wage, when it was first introduced, was about a baseline, and we didn't have a distinction between one part of the state and the other. That was created under Governor Cuomo. I just believe that recognizing that the cost of living varies, but that this bill itself is for a floor.
And so help me understand how you would respond to critics in two different scenarios. The first is that a minimum wage floor would be the Rochester floor, whatever the number is here. We can arbitrarily choose one if we want, but in New York City, they would say, hey, that's a Rochester minimum wage. That's not enough here. And we have to live by this parity that doesn't really exist. On the other side, if the minimum wage floor is more of a New York City minimum wage floor, then Rochester businesses would say, hey, you're making me pay New York City prices, and I'm working in Rochester, and I can't afford to do that. So how do you square that?
Because the subsidies that people would be on if they're not getting paid at that floor doesn't have geographical differences. That's why.
So what should the floor be?
Well, I think it should be graduated over the next, I think we have it over 3 years, to $21 an hour. That's negotiable, but that's how you back into where that dollar amount will be.
Do you buy the argument that that squeezes some businesses, small businesses out?
It does. I used to be a small business owner up until the end of last year. Went through a number of minimum wage increases. I know the impact. You adjust your response to the minimum wage increase in a number of ways. You adjust it by maybe price increases, maybe reducing your profit margin on certain items, maybe adjusting hours. And there will be some businesses that won't be able to do those three areas of adjustment and be successful. However, economists have analyzed this. Every single time, New York State has increased the minimum wage, the economy has grown. And there's study after study that has shown this. And what happens is because the minimum wage is a base, those people who are earning a higher hourly rate immediately goes back into the economy and they spend that money, usually on the necessities, not on luxury items, on necessities. And so the money gets fed right back into the economy, and that in turn supports all businesses, but in particular small businesses. So economists have revealed over and over again that increasing the minimum wage ultimately improves the economy, but that isn't to deny that there are going to be some businesses, their business model's not going to be able to be successful after the increase.
And you're telling them basically adapt or die?
Well, that's a harsh way of putting it, Evan.
I mean, you were a small business owner. It's tough.
And we survived. We survived for 18 years. And there were several of increases in minimum wage during that period of time. And we never, ever laid off a single person as a result of an increase of minimum wage. We did make adjustments in the three areas that I mentioned.
So one other point on minimum wage then. I think you would agree that despite, you know, your invocation of past minimum wage increases leading to a better economy, that at some point there'd be diminishing returns. If we tomorrow went to $100 minimum wage, that could be catastrophic.
Sure.
Okay. So how do you decide where that sweet spot is to know that you haven't kind of gone over the top and now you are jeopardizing the economy?
Yeah. I mean, that is through a lot of very difficult conversations with the business community and others to determine where that is. And I think the business community are a vital voice in all of this because they bring information about what the market will bear and how that will work out. So the sweet spot today may be very different than it is in the future. We've always, since I've been involved in state government since 2004, we have always done incremental increases. The reason for that is twofold. One is so that we're not doing a big hit and so that there can be adjustment. And then the other is so that there's certainty. The beauty of indexing the minimum wage is that there is now ongoing certainty. Employers know if we're having inflation, they're going to know that the minimum wage is going to go up, if the cost of living is going up. So they have that certainty. The other beauty of it is we pull politics out of it. If you look, the minimum wage roughly gets adjusted in New York State every 5 years. So what you're doing is you're delaying increases for 5 years, and then you're hitting employers with an increase. And that's not helpful for them in their planning process.
Too extreme. So you're saying this is more consistent, better able to budget for employers?
Yes.
Okay. One other item that's on a list that you've been working on is anti-bullying. Tell me about that.
So my predecessor, Susan John, enacted a law. I helped her draft it many years ago that would require public employers to put in place an anti-violence measure. Do you remember the phrase, go postal?
I do.
This was a result of that incident. And so it was requiring public employers to put in safety measures against violent behavior of some sort. So what this bill will do that passed both in the Senate and in the Assembly that I sponsored would include a category in that planning, and it would be anti-bullying, to have employers analyze bullying that may be happening from other employees, from management, or from wherever, or the customer, if you will, or the people that that agency is serving. So whether it's the Office of Mental Health, OPWDD, those offices, I mean, it would cover those agencies. And so this just expands what public employers already have to do with anti-violence, but it's adding also a measure to prevent bullying and responding to it if it occurs.
And there is support for this?
A lot of support. The public unions all support it. You know, there was a lot of bipartisan support on this as well.
We're talking to Assemblymember Harry Bronson about the recently passed New York State budget and some of the legislative initiatives that he has been working on. Listeners, if you've got questions, comments, you can send emails to the program connections@wxxi.org. Connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And I'm going to ask producer Megan Mack to fact check me on the fly here because I saw it in passing and I haven't. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to turn to public safety and I want to tell you some comments that I saw recently that Sheriff Todd Baxter of Monroe County made. He was talking about, he was in a store where I think a robbery happened, an armed robbery. And he said that, I mean, as I recall it, he was amazed that the perpetrator, as he described it, was wearing something like flip-flops. And he said, it's the ultimate smack in the face to the idea that people don't think there are any consequences anymore for committing crime to commit an armed robbery wearing flip-flops, to think that, you know, you don't even have to be involved in a chase. Nothing's going to happen to you. And the sheriff has been clear that he thinks that for the last 5 years since bail reform 2019, which has been amended, that he thinks there's still a culture that's been created that says crime pays, that there aren't consequences, et cetera. How do you feel the current state of public safety is, the current state of law, and would you make any more changes?
Well, first of all, I'll say there's not a causative effect there. If that were the case, then we wouldn't see states have similar retail theft happening in their states where they didn't do bail reform, they didn't do raise the age, they didn't do parole reform. Other states are having these same kind of experiences. So I don't think there's a causative effect there. And I disagree with the sheriff on that. These are the things we've done this year. And I have a wonderful list right here. I hope you don't mind. I'm going to read it.
Yeah,
but,
go ahead.
We created a new crime of assault on retail workers. It's a Class E felony. We created a new crime that knowingly fostering the sale of stolen goods. So that's a totally new crime that we just did. Both of those were led by Governor Hochul, and we in the legislature supported it. We amended the larceny statute to allow for the aggregation of the value of retail property stolen if it's pursuant to a common scheme or plan. You know, we've heard a lot of stories about, you know, they go, they rob the Target, they go down the street and rob another retail place. In that scenario, we'll aggregate the dollar amount of the stolen items. And that increased dollar amount means there's stiffer crimes and penalties associated with it. $25.2 million in funding dedicated to state police to help local law enforcement as it relates to retail theft. So similar to what we did earlier with the violent crimes that was happening. Here in Monroe County, an additional $24 million for the various law enforcement departments across this county is in the budget. We've allocated $10 million for the district attorneys to prosecute the retail theft crimes, and an additional $5 million for a local law enforcement to develop units related to retail theft. So a lot of focus on retail theft in this budget and subsequently. So we're trying to address it similar to the way we addressed over the last 2 years the unacceptable level of violent crime here in the city of Rochester, the greater Rochester area, as well as throughout the state.
Robert wants to know about car thefts and says that he thinks there's been a lot of government noise about making change, but essentially he's saying he's still concerned that we're going to see a lot of car theft this summer, primarily Kia Hyundai. What do you see?
So we took steps to reduce that. You know, there was an informational campaign related to it. We have encouraged those manufacturers to get the changes done more quickly in the particular vehicles. But this is, again, this is a phenomenon that's happening across the country, and it is related to young people identifying and learning through social media that somehow, you know, the theft of an automobile is going to give them a status of some sort. Huge problem. We're trying to address it. The theft things that we put in place would be similar. It would help us there as well.
I need to see some updated numbers. We don't have those. I mean, I know RPD probably keeps some, Monroe County Sheriff, so State Police perhaps. So that's something that we should be updating soon, especially as we are now in the warm months. And we are going to be talking about the JEDS program coming up soon on Connections. That's something we've been working on.
Really good program, has really reduced recidivism rates because it's taking young people and getting them connected to services that they need. But let me give you some statistics regarding the incidences related to guns and injury. So in the Finger Lakes area, 2021, 350 such charges. 2022 went down to 303. 2023 down to 247. Constant trend downward. 223 versus 221, we're down 29%. If you look at oftentimes you hear law enforcement talk about you have to look at the five-year average. If you take January to April and you compare that to the five-year average, there's a reduction of 18% of gun-related violence in the Finger Lakes region. Also, constantly are getting complaints about how dangerous New York is. The National Homicide Rate Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, looking at states that have a population of more than 10 million. The national average is 7.6 homicide deaths per 100,000. 7.6. New York has the lowest. We're at 4.3. California, 5.7. Florida, 7.2. Texas, 7.3. All the way up to Georgia, 11 homicides per 100,000 in population. So that's not to say we don't have work to do. We have a lot of work to do. And we need to continue to be intentional and fight against violent crime. But we also need to put this in perspective. And so those statistics, I think, show two things. One, we're trending down. And two, there's a lot of large states that are a lot worse off than we are.
Yeah, I've said on this program in the past, the data supports the general idea that the states that have the fewest gun restrictions, for example, have the highest number of gun homicides or gun crime, gun deaths. The states that have the most restrictions tend to have the fewest.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners can make of that what they want. The overall trends in crime and violence is down in this country over time. That's not a popular thing to say, I guess, in politics. And it may not be a sexy thing to say in news broadcasts, but it is true. Doesn't mean that there isn't crime. There certainly isn't. Mm-hmm. It often disproportionately affects people, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to be covering the JEDS program 2 weeks from today, producer Megan Mack, 2 weeks from today, the 27th. And I hope everybody is listening that day because that's a program that's been held up as a model. We'll talk mm-hmm. more about it that day. Patrick writes to say, I'm a man who puts his boots on every day for work, knowing he's going to have to trudge up and down hills, and that's how I make my money. If I thought I could do my job in flip-flops, I probably would. Committing crimes in flip-flops is brazen. I mean, it is brazen, Patrick. I just think that what the assembly member is saying is that it is not an indication that, well, New York passed certain laws, so therefore now I can go commit crimes and it doesn't matter. It could be an indication of nihilism, mm-hmm. of real despair, of all kinds of ills, but you don't connect it to the laws.
Yeah, I don't. There's other areas and other states that don't have these laws. Their numbers have trended pretty much the same as ours have. And then the other thing is, it's too often we're quick to hear anecdotes and, a one-off and then make a broad brush conclusion. And unfortunately, there's some in our community that are doing that a lot when it comes to public safety and criminal justice.
The Brennan Center has its own report and finds that there is no clear connection between recent crime and the bail reform law enacted in 2019. You can find more at brennancenter.org if you want to read that report. Let me get some more feedback from listeners. This is Eve in Rochester. Hello, Eve.
Hello, Evan. Hello, Harry. I am calling today to talk about something I heard Evan mentioned the other day, which was about how important local history is, and that was with regard to Black jazz musicians. Today I'm calling about Tim O'Maines. Tim was the first openly gay at-large elected official in the United States. This is a really big deal. This is like Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, big deal. And Harry knows I've already talked to him about this in the past, but I want to see a real acknowledgement and commemoration of this someplace in the city, someplace prominent in this city where there would be a statue, a place where the members of the entire LGBTQ plus and everybody else, community at large, could come and do celebrations. So I'm reminding you, Harry, that this is something I'm very serious about.
Okay, Eve, thank you. Assembly Member Bronson?
Sure. Thanks, Eve. As you well know and others, listeners probably know as well, I stand on the shoulders of Tim O'Maines. He was a personal friend and was one of a handful of people who got me involved in this crazy thing called politics and government. I also think he should be honored. He was a trailblazer. He did a lot of work for the LGBTQ community. And he also did a lot of work for children in the education arena. So I agree with you. We should honor his legacy.
Eve, I guess send me a note separately and how you think that could or should happen. And I'll see if there's anything more to add to that. Let me read. I'll get to an email in a second. Let me get Mary in Henrietta with a question about nursing homes. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi. Yeah, I would like to ask Harry how he feels about the reimbursements and the reduction in reimbursements to hospitals and nursing homes, and especially around just getting especially around getting people who need rehabilitation are being sent as far away as Horsehead from Rochester and New York City in order to recoup from a broken leg or something like that. We have a thing called New York Health that Andrea Stewart Cousins won't allow to come up for a vote. It would be like public health insurance for all New Yorkers. We have 130 billionaires in New York State, 750,000 millionaires in New York State. Why aren't we taxing them? We're taxing the middle class and the lower class, but they skate scot-free. And also, Evan, yeah. There's a book called Dying of Whiteness that can tell you all about why states that have loose gun laws have higher rates of suicide and so on and so forth.
Mary, thank you. I appreciate the phone call. Harry Bronson, Assemblymember Bronson, do you want to respond to what's going on with reimbursement rates, nursing homes, et cetera?
So in this year's budget, we did increase the reimbursement rates for both hospital, in-hospital care, as well as out-of-hospital care, and for nursing homes. We didn't go far enough. We made a dent in it, and there needs to be more work. I and my delegation members have met on a regular basis with the local nonprofit nursing homes to discuss their needs, and we must do more, but we made a dent, as we did last year, in last year's budget. So 2 years in a row, we've had increases. I, too, am a supporter of the New York Health Act. It's universal health care, for the lack of better phrase, for New York State. I've been a co-sponsor on that bill ever since I took office in 2011. I continue to support it. The bill in its current version, unlike in 2011, would include the cost of long-term care in nursing homes and assisted living as well. It is an uphill battle to get that bill passed because basically you're shifting the cost of health care. Right now, we're an employer-funded healthcare system, and it would shift it from employer-funded to taxpayer-funded. At the end of the day, the analysis I've seen is individuals and families would be paying less on their health insurance than they currently pay, but because of the way it would get funded, some people are reluctant to move it forward.
Mary, I just want to address one other point. At the very end, you brought up gun violence in states and rates of suicide. Before anybody emails me to make this point, every time this comes up, someone will email me and say, Evan, yeah, but the states that have the highest rates of gun death, a lot of those are suicides. I reject the argument that that is not relevant. I reject it. We're talking about death by gunfire. And the states that have the most guns have the most gun deaths. If you think that suicides don't count or are different, I reject that idea. We're just talking about how many people died from gunfire. That's it. Thank you, Mary. Ryan writes to the program that says, 2 years in a row, the legislature has provided significant funding for SUNY. After years of neglect under the Cuomo administration, many colleges, particularly the comprehensive four-year colleges and community colleges, face deficits. The money allocated would have helped mitigate these problems, yet Chancellor King and the Board of Regents have instead allocated most of this funding to the university centers such as Buffalo, Stony Brook, and Binghamton. And now colleges like Potsdam, Fredonia, and Buff State are cutting entire programs and majors, 37 at Buff State, for instance. Locally, rumors abound of possible cuts at MCC, despite faculty union pushback. Both Brockport and Geneseo face deficits and hiring freezes despite needs for replacement employees. Yet despite calls for the legislature to allocate earmarks directly to struggling campuses, this has not happened 2 years in a row. This could mean that SUNY is no longer an institution serving the whole state, but only privileged regions and fewer students. So the question, what is your guest's stance on this funding issue, and what will they do to ensure SUNY as a system is thriving? Why haven't direct earmarks been made when it is clear that the chancellor and regents have other priorities?
So first of all, let me say, I often say I'm SUNY all the way. I have an undergraduate degree from SUNY Oswego and a law degree from SUNY Buffalo Law. And
is this accurate, by the way? Is this accounting in this email accurate?
This is accurate, and I'm going to address that.
Great.
So I'm SUNY all the way. I'm very supportive, and I credit SUNY Education for helping me live out of poverty, unlike my family members, many of whom still live in poverty. So it is true. We allocate. We've done increases, not adequate increases, but increases for the SUNY system, both on operating costs as well as capital spending. The chancellor has the authority to divvy up that money and has not divvied it up in a way that we think is equitable and fair from one campus to the next. I have participated in signing on to a letter to the chancellor asking him to do the right thing by way of those campuses who are suffering significant deficits. I've been working with UUP to continue to encourage the chancellor to continue to do that. So, you know, I don't think we will ever be able to have in the budget where we make the decision on which campus gets what dollar amount. I think that is going to stay in the hand of the chancellor, but we need to continue to add pressure and try to get Chancellor King to do the right thing and disperse those monies equitably.
You can't earmark and say, here's money, but it's got to be for XYZ.
We could. What I'm saying is I just don't see politically that happening. You know, look, I would do it if I thought it would happen, but I just don't see politically how that would happen, because then what you're going to see, I don't have a single SUNY school in my district, but then you're going to see the representatives of particular SUNY schools trying to get more money to go to them, and that creates a political nightmare.
A few minutes left here. I've tried to ask your colleagues about this. And I think I have an answer, but I'm not totally clear if anybody is actually doing an investigation into Monroe County District Attorney. I know that's at the state level. That was with a investigatory body that hadn't even been convened yet. I've been told this could take 7 to 8 months. Is anything happening? Do you know?
I don't know for sure. I presume the commission that the governor referred the matter to is looking into it, but I've not been briefed one way or the other, and I certainly hope they are. I also don't know what happened on the county level. I know there were some who had indicated it should be referred to the county's ethics committee, whatever that's called, but I don't have the answer to that. I hope so, because I think she should be held accountable for this.
I know you were disturbed, as just about everybody was, by that video. I don't know how anybody wouldn't be disturbed by the video. She has apologized and said that that doesn't represent her as a prosecutor, despite, you know, a long video of berating police, swearing at police, calling the chief, trying to get this thrown out, mocking the idea that as a prosecutor, she would prosecute herself, and then days later putting out a statement that lied to the public about it. She says that's not her. So do you want to just see the investigation complete? I mean, before you decide what you think should happen?
I want to see the investigate complete. But I think, you know, there's some facts that are known today that are revealing. One is it happened. We saw the video. But we also saw a statement from her that at best wasn't accurate, at worst was an outright lie of what happened, so that she could get in front of the story, probably not realizing a video ultimately would come out. But, you know, a ticket like that is public record. Somebody would see that, right? So that creates pause for me. And her apology, I don't think, really acknowledged the problem. And that is, you know, she, like me, we're held to a higher standard, as we should be. And you can't be in law enforcement, and the district attorney's office is law enforcement. You can't be in law enforcement and then feel that you're privileged and you don't have to obey the same laws. And look, I mean, speeding, you know, a lot of people speed. I speed occasionally. But 20 miles over the speed limit in a 35-mile zone is dangerous. That's really dangerous. And, you know, not to acknowledge that, not to acknowledge she then disobeyed a directive by the police officer, numerous directives by the police officer, and to treat that officer with disrespect. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know too many people who can call the police chief when they're refusing to get pulled over and think somehow it's excusable, especially to say he wanted them to know that she wasn't going to be a threat. I mean, it's just absurd.
Well, we'll see where that goes. I mean, I ask because listeners ask me to ask about when state leaders know what's going on, and this is a strange process. It is new, and it's not clear what exactly is happening, but we'll try to stay on top of that. I covered a lot of ground, as we always do, but I'm sure there'll be much more to talk about soon with Assemblymember Harry Bronson from District Number 138. Thank you for being generous with your time.
Thank you so much.
We got more connections coming up in just a moment.